How deluded and ridiculous can these spiritualists get? Doubters with aspirations in the Idiereus negation eld of psychology talk knowingly about secondary personalities, fragmented consciousness, subconscious dramatization and auto-hypnotic phenomena. I do not pretend to know what they all mean, and I doubt if they know it themselves. Some believers in the more rigid orthodoxies do not hesitate to denounce our guides and communicators as evil and impersonating spirits, but they seem forgetful of verse 11 in Psalm 91, which says, "For he shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways." Of course, I know some Christians accept the concept of guardian angels, but since religious art has visualized them over the centuries as Caucasian supermen improbably equipped with wings, one might be forgiven for supposing that spiritual evolution is a privilege only of the white race. The truth is simpler and more wonderful. Angels, guides, spirit helpers, call them what you like, were once men and women of all races and all creeds who once lived on earth. And now, from whatever plane of existence they inhabit, they continue to evolve spiritually by trying to help and uplift mankind through the physical organism of those on earth who have psychic gifts of one kind or another. It is not only psychics and mediums who have spirit helpers, of course. To paraphrase St. Paul, we are all compassed about with a great cloud of witnesses, which does not mean that a host of prying spirits hang around to observe our every action, however private. Simply put, those that we love who have gone ahead of us, care for us still, and they draw near to us when we think of them with longing or when we send out a prayer for help. At my home circle during the war, my spirit helpers were joined by someone who introduced himself as Dr. Marshall, who said he once lived and practiced medicine in Hampstead, London. The personality, which his warm sympathetic voice suggested, was that of everyone's ideal family doctor. From snippets of information Dr. Marshall had given us about himself from time to time, we were able to verify some facts about his life on Earth. Dr. Charles Frederick Marshall was born in Birmingham in February 1864 and received his medical training at Barts Hospital in London, where he gained a reputation for brilliance in both medicine and surgery. He was also interested in psychic research, at a time when the subject was still considered to be cranky, and he eventually became a convinced spiritualist. Originally, Dr. Marshall specialized in diseases of the skin, but he later turned to research in cancer. After years of study, he believed he had discovered a new method of treatment for the disease, and in 1932 he published A New Theory of Cancer. In this book he presented his theories and described a number of advanced cases, which he claimed had been cured by his method. Unfortunately, the medical profession were not interested in this work, and he died on May 22, 1940, a disappointed man. But since he first came through, Dr. Marshall has advised and helped literally thousands of my sitters about their physical health and emotional anxieties. My good friends George and Lynn Archer came to sit with me one day, accompanied by their 20-year-old son Roland, who was in the Merchant Navy. I noticed one of Roland's eyes was swollen, bloodshot and watering profusely, and asked him what was wrong. He told me the eye had been giving him pain and discomfort for months, but none of the doctors he had seen were able to find the cause of the trouble. It was obvious the young man was worried, and particularly so because he had recently seen an eminent ophthalmic specialist who had also failed to find any reason for the symptoms. During the seance, Dr. Marshall came to speak to the Archers, and immediately he touched on the subject of Roland's eye. He reminded the young man of an occasion some months before when he had been on board ship and was cleaning portholes with a bundle of steel wool. Dr. Marshall told him that a tiny particle of the steel wool had broken off and become lodged in his eye, and this was the cause of the pain and irritation. He advised Roland to go back to the eye hospital and tactfully suggest this possibility to the specialist there. Roland took Dr. Marshall's advice, and the particle of steel wool was successfully located and surgically removed. More and more I began to look forward to my sittings with George Woods and Betty Green. The souls who came to speak to them were so varied and so interesting. Some were famous during their time on Earth, others had lived in obscurity, but all of them had something interesting or uplifting to say. These informative talks were recorded on tape so that Betty and George could share their sittings with all who cared to listen. In 1968, at one of these sessions, a spirit with a clear French accent introduced himself as Richer. In the course of the conversation with him, we learned that he was the late Professor Charles Richer, the eminent French physiologist who in 1905 was president of the Society for Psychical Research in London and in 1913 was awarded the Nobel Prize. Professor Richer explained to me how my mediumship was used by those on the other side. He said that every living being has a substance known as ectoplasm, which is a life force, and a physical medium like myself has a great deal more of it than most people. During a séance, this substance, which is sometimes also referred to as the power, is drawn from the medium and fashioned by spirits who understand such matters into a replica of the physical vocal organs. This then is called the artificial voice box or sometimes the mask. The communicating spirit concentrates his or her thoughts into this voice box and in doing so creates a frequency or vibration which reaches the sitters on earth, objectively, as audible sound. The professor went on to describe the difficulties faced by using this method of communication, from the spirit's point of view. He told us that not only must the communicating personality lower their own frequency to match that of earth, but simultaneously they had to remember what their voice sounded like during their lifetime and recapture memories of events to give proof of their identity to the sitters present. When the professor was asked by Mrs. Green whether he could see and hear people at a séance, he replied that it depended on the amount of concentration he put into the efforts to do so. If he focused his mind sufficiently, he could both hear and see people on earth. But he found it simpler to comprehend their thoughts before they were uttered as words. He became a little grumpy when someone suggested that sometimes the voices of spirit communicators did not sound exactly the same as their voices had during their life on Earth. He said it was hardly likely they would sound the same, since they were not using the same vocal organs they had used in life. He added that we must also take into account that the communicating spirit was trying to concentrate on three different things at the same time while communicating. Most of what Professor Richer said to me made sense. I had often heard communicators complain of their difficulty in speaking through this box thing which wobbles about all the time, or speak plaintively about how confusing it was to remember some events that would prove beyond any doubt who they were, while also concentrating so hard on other things. As the discarnate Professor Richer remarked, the miracle is that we can communicate at all. Although some communicators speak in what I regard as standardized voices, by this I mean that one elderly gentleman can sound much the same as another from a similar educational level, and young officers killed in the last war tend to speak in voices which resemble one another. But it is what the entities say and the personality that the voices express, together with the evidence they give, which establishes their identity to those they seek to communicate with. Some spirits, however, perhaps because of their superior mental powers or because of their previous vocation when, on Earth, manage to reproduce voices which are unmistakably like those they had during their lives on Earth. One of these was Lord Birkenhead, a former Lord Chancellor of England, who died in 1930. Under the 1957 Homicide Act, there were five categories of murder punishable by hanging. At a séance I held in 1962 when this act was law, Lord Birkenhead manifested in my séance room and spoke eloquently and quite urgently for almost an hour, on the necessity for total abolition of the death penalty. After he had introduced himself simply as Birkenhead, he said, "This is an aspect of criminal law most in need of change. Whether it is through the hangman's noose or whether it is done by some other supposedly more humane method, nothing justifies the taking of life outside the law or inside it." Admitting that the views he now expressed were quite opposed to those he held on Earth, he explained by saying, "I have seen the effects on this side of life, when the law sends souls here who are unprepared and unready, their minds in turmoil, filled with thoughts of hate, revenge and fear." He told us that these revengeful souls can linger near the earth and impinge their thoughts on individuals who may be mentally unstable and cause them to commit the same kind of crime for which the spirit had forfeited his life under the law. As an alternative to capital punishment, Birkenhead suggested, the unfortunate people who commit murder could be put to useful work. They should be made to serve society in some way and given the opportunity to work out their own salvation and repentance. Towards the end of his impressive speech, he declared, if only it were possible to show you that there is no death, we live and we try constantly to inspire you. I beg of you, I plead with you, to do all in your power to bring this truth to all humanity. When a recording of this communication by Lord Birkenhead was played to one of his former colleagues, Mr. Charles E. Luce by, QC, he said, it is Birkenhead all right. There is not a shred of doubt in my mind. As Birkenhead was responsible for my being called to the bar, become a barrister, I knew him particularly well during virtually the whole of his legal career. Mr. Luce by was later interviewed on television and repeated this statement in front of millions of viewers. I heard about this and remembered Ellen Terry's promise, which at the time had seemed an impossibility. Lillian Bayless, the indomitable woman who owned the world-famous Old Vic Theatre, unexpectedly made a dramatic speech at a séance I held in 1963. 2 days earlier the curtain had been brought down at her theatre for the last time before the National Theatre Company took over. Miss Bayless expressed her dismay that the Vic had not been retained as a training school for aspiring students of the theatre and asked if it were really necessary to lose a name which had for so long upheld English drama. Surely it could have been kept as a memorial to the past, she asked sadly. When one of the sitters asked if she had been present at the final performance in her theatre, Miss Bayless answered with a trace of impatience, "Of course I was there. Do you think I would be missing for the last act? It was a sad night, but for me a proud one. I am sure there, new, National Theatre must be a success because its roots were in the Old Vic and those roots were strong." Miss Bayless told us many other famous theatrical figures from the past were also present on that farewell night, including her aunt, Emma Cons, who years before had run the Old Vic as a people's theatre. When a recording of Lillian Bayless' dramatic séance talk was played to Captain P. Newcomb of Hove, he wrote, the tape recording did certainly bring us an exact picture of the late Miss Bayless as I remember her, the voice and mannerisms were unmistakable. I am most grateful for the opportunity of hearing my dear old friend once again. When the goddaughter of the late Lillian Bayless, Mrs. Alice Watson, also heard the recording, she wrote, I am only too happy to deny Dieris's negation RM that it was the voice of Lillian Bayless I heard. One evening I was visiting Rose Crete, who lived in the upper flat at Westbourne Terrace. We were chatting about this and that when I began to feel a strong personality suddenly impinge on me psychically. Although I tried to ignore this awareness, eventually it became too strong to resist and I suggested that if we drew the curtains and put out the light we might find out who this personality was. The curtains were drawn and the light put out, but only partial darkness was possible. Fortunately Rose had a tape recorder. The incomplete blackout did not stop the personality I had sensed from speaking almost immediately, in a strong voice with a decidedly Irish lilt. At first we did not know who the voice belonged to. He mentioned his plays and said that despite their success he had no desire to return to Earth again. When he said, having been George Bernard Shaw is enough for anyone, we greeted him with delight. In his lifetime Shaw had always expressed his disbelief in a life beyond the grave and when Rose asked him to tell us something about his arrival in the spirit world he flippantly replied, I never knew a woman who was so anxious to know about death before. Why don't you wait until you come? When Rose persisted with her question Shaw answered, I was very much surprised and very much perturbed, but at the same time I was elated. If one can have three such different emotions at once. When one of us tried to get him to criticize the theater of today, he refused saying that he no longer condemns because he had learned it was a sin. I have never been terribly keen to be a sinner, he said. In fact, when I tried to be a sinner, I was never very successful, much to my great disappointment. I wanted to sin once or twice with several very charming ladies, but they would only sin by correspondence, which was no satisfaction to me at all. I was a bit of a sentimental old fool, you know, but I wouldn't let people know it. At least I tried to avoid them realizing it. I used to put on the brusque manner, you know, and try and waggle my beard and frighten them. I didn't always succeed. I did it much better by postcards. Break. I was much more successful with my pen than ever I was with my tongue. When a tape of Shaw's Spirit Voice was played to his friend Lawrence Easterbrook Obey, he wrote, "I found the G.B. Shaw recording interesting indeed. The more I think about it, the more impossible it seems for anyone but himself to have been responsible. It brought back to me the sense of infectious gaiety you got with him when he was in the family circle and not showing off." Concerning the same recording, the Reverend William Allen Barham wrote in June 1970, "I played the GBS tape to George Bishop, dramatic critic of the Daily Telegraph, and a close friend of Shaw for many years. After Mr. Bishop had listened to the tape, he declared, 'The mind and the mood are Shaw's. Not all the personalities who came to speak to George Woods and Betty Green at their regular sittings were well known in life. There were many men and women who had lived and died quite unremarkably, but who came to talk about themselves and to tell us how they died and what they found on the other side of death. One of these was Edward Butler, who spoke in a warm Yorkshire accent and invited us to call him Ted. He told us he had lived in Leeds until one Saturday morning in 1923 when he went shopping with his wife. As Ted put it himself, I was crossing the high street and before you could say Jack Robinson something hit me. It was a lorry and it got me pinned against the wall and I was out. Then he told us he saw a crowd looking down at something, so he went to have a look and to his surprise he saw a man on the ground who looked just like him. I didn't realize it was me at first," he said. "I thought that fellow looks exactly the same as I do, break. He could be my twin brother." Ted did not realize he was looking at his own body lying on the ground. When he saw his wife in the crowd, she was crying. He tried to tell her he was all right, but she ignored him completely. When the ambulance arrived, Ted got inside with his wife and the body, and during the ride to the hospital he finally realized what had happened. Later Ted talked about attending his own funeral. "I thought at the time, all this fuss and expense for nothing. Because here I was in the horse-drawn carriage with the wife and nobody took any notice of me." According to his own account, Ted had been a material kind of fellow. He had given no thought to religion and had no belief in an afterlife. It seems he was earthbound for a time, because he hung around his home, traveled on tram cars and visited friends, but no one could see him or hear him and he began to be lonely and unhappy. Sometimes he even longed for a glass of beer. But even though he felt solid enough to himself, when he tried to pick up a glass his hand went right through it. At another sitting we heard a male voice with a German accent. Speaking with some difficulty he gave his name as Dr. Frank and told us that during the war he had been a prisoner in Dachau concentration camp, where he was killed because he refused to do certain things he did not like. He went on to describe the miserable conditions of life in Dachau and told us that when he was first sent there he had been allowed to use his medical skill to help other prisoners. Then Dr. Frank tried to explain how his captors had insisted that he cooperate in some of the horrific surgical experiments performed on the prisoners and when he refused to participate he was executed. He told us that over the site of Dachau camp, even today, there hangs an atmosphere of misery, unhappiness and evil because of all the things which were done there. When Dr. Frank was asked about his current life in the spirit world he told us he was still a doctor, but now he treated souls by helping them to get rid of their old stagnant ideas, fear, hatred and prejudices which impede their spiritual progress. Before he left us Dr. Frank said, "If people would realize that thoughts in themselves are powerful and that as a man thinks, so he is, break. He creates for himself his own heaven and hell by his thoughts." In 1963 the John Profumo scandal shook Britain and Stephen Ward, a fashionable osteopath and artist of some talent, stood trial at the Old Bailey on charges arising from the affair. While he was still on bail and before verdict or sentence could be given Ward took his own life. "I had never met Stephen Ward nor any of his friends. The social circles in which we moved were too far apart for that and I knew nothing of him apart from what I had read or heard in the mass media. I was therefore all the more surprised when soon after his lonely and pitiful death Stephen Ward was brought to speak during one of my sittings. In a hoarse, strained whisper Ward said that he regretted the circumstances of his passing, but his conscience was clear regarding the crimes of which society had accused him. I admit that I was foolish, break. Of course I made mistakes, break. A lot of the rubbish they've spoken about and printed is quite untrue, break. I ought to have stuck it out to the end. Not long after his first communication, Stephen Ward returned to speak again, and this time his voice was stronger and he was able to talk for a longer period. Once more he expressed regret for ending his own life, but said he had felt a net of lies closing in on him. He told us he had kept his mouth shut to protect others, yet those who could have supported him were thinking of themselves all the time. They deliberately kept out of court, break. It was a dirty business, he said. Ward believed he was the scapegoat in an affair which was basically political, but behind it was something more sinister. He told us his suicide had not solved his problems but had made them harder to bear. He also spoke about some writings he had left behind for publication and seemed to think they would be suppressed in England but might be published in another country before long. In fact, I believe his memoirs were published in France not long after this second communication. Stephen Ward continued to communicate at my séances for a number of years, and I can report that he has progressed spiritually, to the point where he forgives himself for his actions and his vanity and no longer bears any resentment towards the friends who deserted him in his hour of need. Ethel and Alfred Scarfe, who live in Ipswich, had been sitting with me for some time and sending out copies of their séance recordings to inquirers, in the same way as George Woods and Betty Green had been doing for so long. In a sitting in January 1964, Mr. and Mrs. Scarfe were contacted by an evolved soul who told them he was once a member of the Catholic Church. He said he had been a monk in a great monastery in the place we now call Bury St. Edmunds. He told them to call him Brother Boniface and described himself as something of a rebel in his day. Since that first communication, Brother Boniface has spoken with Mr. and Mrs. Scarfe on many occasions, and always with a fluency and a beauty of phraseology at which I can only marvel. He raises all kinds of moral questions, and one of his recurring themes is the evil folly of discrimination on grounds of race, color, class or creed. The Scarfes have sent many recordings of his talks on this theme to friends in South Africa, and letters constantly come back from there asking for more copies. On one occasion I played a recording of Brother Boniface to the pastor of a church in the West End of London. He listened with interest and then asked if he might borrow the tape to play to one or two friends. Gladly I agreed to lend it to him. Sometime afterwards another friend of mine, who was a member of the pastor's fashionable congregation, reported to me that the pastor had delivered Brother Boniface's discourse practically verbatim as his Sunday sermon, but needless to say he had not mentioned his source. By the beginning of 1970, George and Betty had built up a library of more than 200 tape recordings of spirit voices. The communicators speak in all manner of accents and dialects, and though many were famous in their lives on earth, others were ordinary women and men who returned to tell us of their experiences when they died and what they found when they reached the other side of life. There is one recording in this comprehensive collection which had us puzzled for a long time. At that séance, Mickey announced that he was bringing two people who had lived in ancient times to speak to George and Betty. Soon we all heard a male and a female voice talking together in some unknown tongue. After a time, the woman sang several little ditties. We still hope that one day we will find someone who will not only be able to identify the language but to translate the recording into English. I had been living and working quietly and obscurely for almost 18 years when, without warning, one Sunday morning I opened the newspaper to find a double page spread on my work with George and Betty. A further article on the following Sunday concluded, "This was an extraordinary case with evidence to suggest a conscious life after death." As a result of this unsought publicity, I was invited to be interviewed on television. Some of the spirit voice recordings from George and Betty's sittings were played during the program. One of them, fittingly, was the voice of Ellen Terry, So I did my best to explain the truth as I know it, to the millions of people watching. Picture text page 259. Betty Green, George Woods and Leslie Flint, interviewed on television in 1970 by Eamon Andrews. 14 When my old friend Father Sharp died in 1960, he was 94 years of age. He had never ceased to hope that one day the brave dream of the confraternity of clergymen would become a reality and spiritualism would be brought within the framework of the established church. One of the most grievous disappointments of his life was the suppression of the report on spiritualism by the Church of England. A committee of 10 church members had been appointed by William Temple, Bishop of Manchester, and Dr. Cosmo Lang, Archbishop of York, with the intention of investigating the claims of spiritualism. By the time their investigations were completed, Lang had been made Archbishop of Canterbury. By a majority verdict, his committee reached the conclusion that the claims of spiritualism to communicate with the dead, through specially gifted persons, were true, but Lang suppressed the findings and the report was never published. Cosmo Lang died in 1945, and 1 year later he spoke to Father Sharp in our home circle through my mediumship. This is what he had to say: "If only I could have my life over again with the knowledge I now have, how differently I would act. I could have done so much, but I was afraid." He went on to speak of the thousands of young souls sent into the next world by the war and were resentful, because the church had not taught them that death is not the end and that a bridge can be made between the two worlds. In 1959, Cosmo Lang spoke on another occasion in my séance room when George Woods and Betty Green were present. He said he felt strongly that spiritualism was so vital and so important that everyone should know about it, but he admitted he had been afraid it could undermine the church and probably even destroy it. He also felt that knowledge of spirit communication could be dangerous if used in the wrong way, so he suggested that colleges or societies should be organized where mediums could be trained in the proper manner, break, where they could be sheltered and fed, break, where they can make mediumship a vocation. Although he warned that, if you are to contact the highest forces, break, those who can help the world to uplift mankind, we must have mediums of like mind and of like thought, because unfortunately many were of a very low order. More dangerous still, Lang said, were seances led by poorly trained mediums, which could allow us to be obsessed by entities who will distort you and distort truth, who will give to you falsehoods and mislead you. He told us how important it is to choose our mediums carefully and conduct ourselves in the right way when we sit, and that first we should approach God, not only when we pray but in our daily lives. The former archbishop went on to say, "I don't want you to think I condemn. Far from it. I am anxious to help, of course. But I do feel that only when spiritualism is placed in its right perspective, when it is used and applied in the right way, when it has the instruments who are of a higher mental and spiritual level, who will give up all in true service to God, looking upon themselves as mere instruments of His divine power to serve the children of the earth, and who have that feeling of desire for self-sacrifice, to give up all in service and to tune in with the highest and the finest that can come through from our world, break, then it seems to me that while you are, as it were, only scratching the surface of the astral worlds, of which 90% of your instruments seem to be doing, then, it is not only bad, but it can even be dangerous. Because like can attract like, and also lower entities who are earthbound, who cling to the earth, can come through and speak to people of things which are not true, and can also be the cause of much unhappiness, much misery." Lang told us how far adrift he felt the church of today had gone, away from its original teachings and its original spiritual force for good. He said he realized where it went wrong after it strayed and erred from the simple path that Jesus prepared. He told us the teachings of spiritualism were akin to the essence of the early church and those first Christians who gathered together and who were possessed of the power of the Lord and who overcame the flesh and gave up all to follow Jesus. He concluded by saying, "I know that if this great and glorious truth were proclaimed and if it were demonstrated and made manifest in the true sense, the whole world would be changed. In September 1960, a recording of Lang's communication was played at the London Conference of the Church's Fellowship for Psychical and Spiritual Studies. It brought much discussion among those members who had known Dr. Lang during his lifetime.